Now, the title of my first talk this afternoon is The Growth of Government in the United States. In his book, which is now almost 50 years old, A Christian View of Men and Things, Clark comments that the growth of government is the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And there are lots of tragedies in the 20th century. And 50 years ago, he identified that as the greatest. And if you think about it, you think about the growth of governmental power in the form of totalitarianism in particular. You have the communist movement, the Nazis, the fascists. But that's not all. There's also the exercise of government power in war, and the 20th century has been the worst century, the bloodiest century in history that we know of, as far as wars. And even in crimes, individual crimes committed by government, you have an exercise of government power. The Austrian economist Mises coined a term about 50 years ago, statolatry. He combined the word state and idolatry, and it identifies one of the primary idolatries of the 20th century is the idolatry of government. And he used the term he coined, statolatry, to identify that. And I think that's a very good topic to keep in mind. Death by government in the 20th century has been horrendous. A few years ago, R.J. Rummel, a political scientist from Hawaii, the University of Hawaii, published a book by that title, Death by Government, in which he spent a chapter discussing how various governments have slaughtered their own people over the years. And the numbers he gave, some of them seem low to me, but you may be surprised by some of them. He identified the Soviet government as killing 62 million of its own people. 62 million of its own people. Through famine, through the gulag, through firing squads, various methods. The Red Chinese, and no one talks about Red Chinese anymore. When's the last time you heard the phrase Red Chinese? Or even Communist Chinese. It's mainland China now. It's not even identified as a communist regime. And in my opinion, he might be low on this, but we'll accept his number of 35 million by the Red Chinese government, the mainland Chinese government. The Nazis, 21 million. 21 million for the Nazis. People forget that their slaughter of the Jews was simply a part of their program of genocide. And they didn't start with Jews. They started with the deformed. They started with those who they said enjoyed a life unworthy of living. They started in the hospitals, and they branched out from there to the gypsies and the various other ethnic groups, and finally the Jews. And the total for the Nazi regime was 21 million. The nationalist Chinese, 10 million. 10 million slaughtered by the nationalist Chinese government. The Japanese government, we forget about its war in China, among other things. 6 million slaughtered by the Japanese government. A book came out a couple years ago, The Rape of Nanking. Again, people forgot about the rape of Nanking in many ways because it was eclipsed by some other horrendous things done by government in the 20th century. But the Japanese government, 6 million people. Cambodia, you've heard about Cambodia and Pol Pot and the killing fields. There was a movie made about the killing fields. 2 million. Turkey, and these are all lesser criminals here, all the way down from Turkey, Vietnam, Poland, Pakistan, Yugoslavia, North Korea, Mexico, and feudal Russia, anywhere from 1 to 2 million. Victims of governments in the 20th century. I recommend the book. If you haven't seen the book, we don't have it here. But it's Death by Government by R.J. Rummel. Well, the growth of government isn't new. It may be the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, but it's certainly not new. If you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Samuel 8. And let's read about the growth of government in Republican Israel. I don't mean as opposed to democratic Israel, but I mean the Hebrew system of government was a republic. That's the system that God set up. And there you find a description of the growth of government and what it does and how wrong it is, long before Plato and Aristotle wrote their books, and much more perspicacious than either Plato or Aristotle, who were totalitarians. We read in 1 Samuel 8, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make for us a king to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should reign over them. And according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them.' So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, 'This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day.' Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.' And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed their voice and make them a king.' And Samuel said to the men of Israel, 'Every man go to his city.' And Israel got their king." Well, here you have an account of the demand of the growth of government. Later on, in a few minutes, we'll talk about the reasons for that growth of government. I just want to point out now what the warnings are that God gives to Israel through Samuel. He's going to take your property, this big government that you're demanding. He's going to take your persons, and he's going to take your freedom. That's what he's going to do. And that's what big government has done throughout the centuries. Now, in America, we have experienced that in the 20th century. But we've also experienced something else that has made the growth of government tolerable to the American people. And that something else is the growth of the American economy. The growth of the American economy. The history of the United States, thank you. The history of the United States is a history of spectacular economic progress, perhaps unparalleled in all of human history. Throughout this century, the American economy has grown at a real rate, that is a rate adjusted for inflation, between 3 and 4% a year. Since 1900, The real incomes of American families have doubled roughly every 30 years. That means in every subsequent generation, the children have lived twice as well as their parents. Per capita income has risen in real terms from $3,000 in 1900 to $20,000 today. Now, these are terms adjusted for inflation. They're real terms. We're not talking about comparing $1,999 with $1,900. Those are not the same things. But adjusting for inflation, real per capita income has gone from about $3,000 to $20,000. In this century, the standard of living in the United States has more than quadrupled. In this century, the U.S. developed a reputation as the world's job machine. From 1900 to 1980, the U.S. created an average of 8 million new jobs each decade. 8 million new jobs each decade. Those who wanted to destroy the machine in the early 19th century, the Luddites, seem to have been wrong. In the 1980s, the job machine shifted into overdrive. And in that decade alone, 18 million new jobs were created within the United States. This is more jobs than were created in Japan, Korea, Germany, Sweden, or Great Britain combined. Sometimes we Americans, because we're so close to it, don't realize what an enormous economy the U.S. is. Now, this rapid growth, unfortunately, has made many Americans tolerant of the growth of government. So long as they have enough take-home pay to meet their mortgages, to pay their bills, many people really don't care if the government takes 25 or 30 or 35% or more of their income, because the economy has grown so rapidly. What I'd like to show you now is some indicators of the growth of government in the U.S. so we get some idea of how rapidly the growth of government has taken place and how much more rapidly it has expanded than the economy itself. Now, the economy has grown tremendously. We're talking about quadrupling the standard of living in a century, each generation living better than the one before it. Then there are four indicators that I'm going to point to give you some idea, some estimate, of how much government has grown. I'm going to look at spending, taxes, the number of government employees or agents, and the number of laws and regulations on the books. So if I could have the first overhead there on real federal outlays, 1800 to 1994. Now, real, again, the word indicates that these numbers have been adjusted for inflation. We're trying to compare, as the graph shows, millions of $1,990 dollars. Trying to reduce the equivocation on the word dollar and use a univocal meaning for the word dollar. You see there, throughout the 19th century, it doesn't move off the bottom of the graph in real terms. The fastest economic growth that the economy enjoyed was in the latter part of the 19th century up to World War I. There you see a beginning movement before and after the 20s, up before 1920s, World War I obviously, and down a little bit after 1920. Due to the reforms of Andrew Mellon, who was Secretary of the Treasury in the 1920s. But then you'll see, beginning in 1930, during the administration of Herbert Hoover, a real growth, in the size, the spending of government at the federal level. And it's just taken off since then. For much of our history, up until 1930, it's virtually flat. You get some movement around World War I. But after that, it just goes out of sight. So you have this enormous growth in government spending, the real federal outlays. George Washington's first budget, $750,000 for George Washington's first budget. If I could have the second overhead there, the real per capita outlays, 1800 to 1994. This is real per capita. Now, this is adjusted not only for inflation, but for population. People would say, well, obviously the government's going to spend more because we have a lot more people than we did in George Washington's day. So we can adjust it now for population as well, real per capita federal outlays. Moving again to something slightly off the bottom of the graph there in 1800, to nearly $5,000 per capita in 1994. Actually, the real per capita federal outlays in 1800 were $100 million, $20 per person. $20 per person. By 1850, in real outlays, the federal government was spending $600 million. By 1900, $8.3 billion in real dollars, 1990 dollars. Spending $110 per person, up from $20 in 1800. But by 1994, the government was spending $1.5 trillion in the official budget. And we won't get into the shady bookkeeping they engage in. But in the official budget, it's $1.5 trillion in 1994. $5,000 per person, approximately. This is an increase of 2,500 times in real per capita federal outlays since 1800. And those numbers are just adjusted for both inflation and population. 2,500 times. Now, you knew it was bad, Neil, but you didn't know it was that bad. Could I have overhead three, please? This next one is comparing the U.S. federal budget not to the budgets of other governments, but to the budgets of, to the entire economies of other nations. $1.5 trillion in 1994. The entire economy, as far as it can be estimated, in China was $450 million, Italy $965 million. The fellow who made this obviously put Italy on here twice. I presume he was an Italian and wanted to make sure his country was mentioned prominently there. India $328 million, Australia $331 million. Germany comes close, $1.3 trillion. Spain, $487 million. France, $1 trillion. Canada, $521 million. The United Kingdom, $915 billion. Now, what this means, among other things, is that the federal budget alone, federal spending alone, is about the same size as the entire economy of China, India, Australia, and Spain in 1994. The entire economies of those nations. Could I have overhead number five?
Five or four?
Well, I'm sorry, four. This is federal spending as a percent of gross domestic product in the 20th century. Federal spending as a percent of gross domestic product in the federal in the 20th century. Less than 3% in 1900, 2.8. 27% in 1993. 27% in 1993. Now, what's the import of this set of statistics? Well, one of the implications here is that the federal spending is growing 10 times as fast as the economy. When you look at federal spending as a share of the gross domestic product, the GDP, And it grows from 2.8% of the GDP in 1900 to 27% in 1993. It's a growth 10 times as fast as the economy. And the economy is already growing fast, as we mentioned earlier. Now could I have five? Let's look at federal spending in some detail in the next few overheads. And the first one is on healthcare spending. This is from 1900 to 1990. Now, the spending is negligible in 1900. Again, it's in real terms. All of these numbers are adjusted for inflation. I'm not trying to fool you by comparing apples and oranges and comparing a gold-backed dollar in 1900 to a fiat currency in the 1990s. These are adjusted for inflation. Negligible in 1900 as far as the healthcare expenditures go. By 1930, it's up to $1 billion in real terms, but by 1994, it's $210 billion in real terms at the federal level. Now, if you do the math here, from $100 million to $210 billion, you're talking about another increase of over 2,000 times in the 20th century. Probably veterans. The Veterans Administration was set up after the Civil War, or the war between the states.
Yeah.
Yes, the War of Northern Aggression. veterans sometimes get upset, but that is the only federal outlay for health care at that time. Now, this graph here partially explains the skyrocketing cost of health care in the last 30 years. You have these enormous federal outlays for health care, especially look at the difference between 1960 and 1994. Of course, in the mid-60s, you have Medicare and Medicaid being enacted into law, and this increased demand drives up the price for all sorts of health care. And this partially explains the skyrocketing cost of health care in the last 30 years. The federal government gets into the business and drives up the price for everyone. Could I have six on agricultural spending, please? Again, this is the federal government. The dollars are adjusted for inflation. Covers the period 1900 to 1994. Again, ag spending in 1900 is not quite zero, but it's virtually zero in real terms. By 1994, it's $55 billion. And again, you see the most growth in absolute terms, not in percentage terms perhaps, but at least in absolute terms, occurs after 1960. There are two watersheds, political, economic watersheds, in American history in the 20th century. One is the Roosevelt administration, the 1930s, and the other is the Johnson administration in the 1960s. Number seven, please. Number seven is on housing, federal housing spending. Real federal housing expenditures, 1900 to 1994. Virtually zero. In 1900, $21 billion. In 1994, an increase of 700 times since 1930. 700 times since 1930. And there you see the virtually all the growth has occurred since the Great Society was instituted in the 1960s. Number eight is federal interest payments, or interest payments on the federal debt. 1870 to 1994. We had some debt left over after the war between the states in 1870. And that was virtually paid off by the end of the century. And then government begins to grow, or the debt begins to grow, and the interest payment with it. We're paying $6 billion in real terms by 1930. $200 billion in real terms by 1994. 30 times as much as there was in interest payments. Now, what's one of the interesting things about the interest payments is that interest payment there, $200 billion, that was the entire size of the federal budget up until about the 1960s. That was the entire federal budget, $200 billion. In 1994, it became just the interest payment. The deficit, or the debt itself, the national debt itself, it wasn't until 1981 that the national debt hit $1 trillion, the official debt. There's also the unfunded liabilities of the government, such as Social Security and federal retirement programs and that sort of thing. But the official debt did not hit $1 trillion until 1981. It took 6 years to hit $2 trillion, 1987. It took only 2 years more to hit $3 trillion. This is in the conservative Reagan administration. That it takes from 1788 to 1981 to pile up the first trillion in debt. And the next $2 trillion are piled up during the Reagan administration in the national debt. Now, $4 trillion... The national debt hits $4 trillion in 1995, $5 trillion in 1997. And if you have some suspicions about the current news about the budget being in surplus, they are justified. What you should look at is not the budget figures, but look in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, look at the debt figures for the U.S. government. And tell me if the debt is going down or up. And you'll see it continues to increase, despite all the talk about the surplus in the budget. The debt figures continue to increase at the federal level. Could I have number 9, please? Number 9 is defense spending. There are one or two things that the government has a legitimate role in. And protecting the persons and property within its borders is one of those things. This is not absolute figures for defense spending, and there's an enormous waste in the defense budget. I'm not defending the Pentagon by any means. But I want to show you how, as a percent of the total federal spending, defense spending has declined since 1800. In 1800, we have a defense spending level of about 54% of the budget at the federal level. Today, it's about 15% of the federal budget. Well, that is just the good news at the federal level. The next overhead is on state spending. And lest you think the states are pure and it's only the federal government that has grown enormously, here's a real per capita state spending in the 20th century, 1900 to 1992. Per capita spending rises from $32 of state spending in 1900 to nearly $2,500 in 1992, per capita. See, it's already adjusted for inflation and population. These numbers cannot be faulted. They can be faulted in other ways, perhaps, but they cannot be faulted by saying we're playing tricks with because we're comparing a population of 260 million with a population of 3 million. By reducing it to per capita spending, you've eliminated that. And here you see this enormous growth of 80 times, 78 times, in per capita spending at the state level. Not the federal level. This is state spending. Let's look at number 11. Unless you think the local governments are doing their job, and it's just the state and the federal that there's a problem with. Look at 11 here. This is per capita local spending in real terms from 1900 to 1992. It rises from approximately $200 in real terms to $2,400 in per capita local spending, an increase of about 12 times in the 20th century at the local level. Could I have number 12, please? Now, this one is going to combine local, state, and federal spending 1900 to 1995. These are the combined expenditures of government in the United States, rising from about $50 billion in real terms in 1900 to $2450, almost $2.5 trillion by 1995. 49 times increase. Now, did the population of the United States increase 49 times in that period? Not by a long shot. Not by a long shot. Let's look at number 13. This makes the spending perhaps more understandable when you break it down to households. This is total government spending, federal, state, and local, per household, 1900 to 1994. Rises from $1,651 in 1900 in real terms to $23,138 in 1994. A 14 times increase. 14 times as much per household. Number 14 is total government outlays as a share of the gross domestic product. 1900 to 1992 rises from 8.9% in 1900 to 36.8%, which means, among other things, it's growing four times as fast as the economy in that period. Four times as fast. But there's something even more interesting about federal, state, and local spending, and that's how it has shifted. We've seen how they have all grown in the 20th century. But it's interesting how they have shifted. For instance, in 1930, as a percent of national income, the federal government spent 3% in 1930. The state and local government spent 9% in 1930. By 1940, the federal government was spending 13% of national income, which was more than the combined federal, state, and local in 1930. And the state and local governments were spending 12%. Federal spending as a percentage, or government spending as a percentage of national income, had doubled in the 1930s. By 1990, the federal government is spending 28% of national income and 14% of state and local income. State and local governments are spending 14% of national income. And the total is about 42% of national income. So you see, not only are they all increasing, but the state and local percentage of spending is falling relative to the federal government. So there is something to the idea that the spending is shifting toward Washington and away from state and local governments, even though they're all growing very rapidly. Number 15, please. This is welfare spending, total welfare spending, 1930 to 1994. $10 billion in 1930, $210 billion in 1994. This is federal, state, and local again. 21 times it grows in that 64-year period. Number 16 is the total government income transfer. Now, this includes, in addition to welfare, things such as Social Security. Income transfer, in real terms, from 1900 to 1990, $10 billion in 1900 in real terms, $1 trillion in 1990 in real terms, a growth of 100 times, 100-fold in the 20th century. These are income transfer payments. Now, this is the sort of thing God is talking about in 1 Samuel 8. He will take from you and give to his servants. He will take from you and give to his friends. Those are income transfers. And here you have the income transfer growing 100 times in the 20th century. Well, let's look at taxes. Let's get away from spending a little bit and look at taxes for a moment. Number 17 is the federal tax rates from 1913 to 1994. And those are the top rates of the income tax. And you can see how they started out fairly low, 7%. And of course, they applied to almost no one in 1913, 1914. The income tax was sold by appealing to envy, the envy of the American people. The argument, or one of the arguments that was used, was we've got to soak the people like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the robber barons who have piled up millions of dollars. And that's the purpose of the income tax. It's a graduated income tax. We're going to soak the rich. We're going to tax them, and an ordinary American will never have to pay this tax. And if you go back and you read the statements that were used in defense of the income tax, you'll find appeals to envy like that all the time. It was a tax designed to make the rich pay their fair share. Well, back in those days, the New York Times and the Washington Post had a different point of view than they do now. And I want to read you a couple of quotations about the idea of a federal income tax from the Washington Post and the New York Times. This is what the New York Times said. It editorialized, "A vicious, inequitable, unpopular, impolitic, and socialistic act." That's how the New York Times described a federal income tax. When it was first, the proponents of the income tax first proposed it in 1894, and the Supreme Court struck it down as unconstitutional. And the Times said, "It's vicious, inequitable, unpopular, impolitic, and socialistic." and I'm sure someone told them not to hold back. Let us know what you really think about the income tax here. Went on to say, "It's the most unreasoning and un-American movement in politics in the last quarter century." Now, this is quite different from what the New York Times would write today about the income tax. The Washington Post weighed in as well. "It's an abhorrent and calamitous monstrosity," wrote the Washington Post about the graduated income tax at the same time. "It punishes everyone who rises above the rank of mediocrity. The fewer additional yokes put around the necks of the people, the better." That's the Washington Post. And then the Times editorialized again in 1909 when the constitutional amendment, the 16th Amendment, was put on the table to get the states to ratify that so that the income tax would be constitutional. This is what the Times wrote in 1909. "When men get in the habit of helping themselves to the property of others, they cannot be easily cured of it." And they cannot. Now let's go on to overhead number 18. On Social Security taxes. This is our second federal income tax. Many people don't think of this as an income tax, but the Social Security tax is an income tax. It's a payroll tax, as much as the so-called income taxes. I'm not sure if some of the gentlemen who are proposing, advocating the repeal of the 16th Amendment realize that if it goes, the Social Security tax goes too. That would end Social Security taxes, the repeal of the 16th Amendment, because that's their only constitutional basis as an income tax. Well, here's the numbers from 1940 to 1990. The tax rate in 1940 is 2%. This is both employer and employee. It's 1% on each. And the amount of income that was taxed was, the ceiling was $3,000. So the total tax paid by both employer and employee in 1940 was $60. That's the total tax. Today, the income tax rate is something over 15%, combined employer and employee. And I'm not sure what the tax base is. Is it about $60,000?
I think it's about $75,000.
$75,000 now? So you can see how much greater it is, than it was in 1940, when it was, or 1935, when it was enacted. It's a regressive tax, the economists tell us. What does that mean? Well, the progressive tax imposes a higher tax rate on people with higher incomes. So you have different tax brackets until you get, as the previous overhead showed, up to the 40% bracket. The Social Security income tax is a regressive tax. That is, the higher your income goes, the lower your tax rate is, because you pay the tax only on the first $75,000 you make. So if you make $1 million a year, you don't pay the tax on $925,000 of it. Your tax rate goes to zero in that income tax. So it's a regressive tax rate, regressive tax system. Number 19, if I could have number 19, please. This is the real per capita federal taxes, 1800 to 1990. Again, adjusting for inflation and population. Notice that there is a noticeable decline in the 1920s. Again, thanks to Andrew Mellon, who tried to do some tax reform in the 1920s. And you see per capita federal taxes are declining in that period. You also see a decline in the 1980s. This is the effect of the Reagan tax cut in the 1980s. Now, real per capita federal taxes, again, they stay down near the bottom. There's a slight rise. You have to have good eyes to see it around the time of the Civil War. And then a greater rise in the second half of the 19th century. But it's essentially flat in real terms up until World War I. And then it declines slightly in the 20s. Then it goes, heads for the sky, heads for the ceiling after that. $4,200 in real per capita federal taxes in 1990.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
Overhead number 20, total taxes per household, 1900 to 1994. Rise from $1,370 to $18,600 in 94 in real terms, $1,990. A 14-fold increase in total government taxes, federal, state, and local, in the 20th century. Overhead 21. This is the tax burden on an average family of four, 1994. Tax burden on an average family of four. About half of their income is paid in taxes, more than food, clothing, and shelter combined. Federal taxes consume about 25% of their income. Now, that's just not the income tax. It's the Social Security tax. It's the federal excise tax on gasoline, that sort of thing. State and local taxes consume about 10% of their income. And indirect taxes, that is taxes you don't even realize you're paying because they've been taxed at some other level in the economy, consume about 15% of your income. And the remainder is about half your income. But still, the economy has grown so rapidly that half your income is what, at least what your parents were making, and probably more in many cases. And people, many people will say, well, I'm living as good or as better than my parents, so I don't care if they take 30 or 40%. Doesn't bother me. Now let's turn to another measure of the growth of government in the 20th century, which is the number of employees. Overhead 22. These are manufacturing employees, the number, and the number of government employees. From 1940 to 1992, notice the lines cross in 1992. Government employees versus manufacturing employees, the lines cross in 1992. The next slide is the number of IRS agents. From 1914 or 1913 to 1993, an increase of 29 times, from 4,000 to 125,000. in that period from 1913 to 1993, approximately 80 years. There's a line in the Declaration of Independence about King George III. He has sent out swarms of agents to eat out our substance. Jefferson, I guess, was trying to draw an analogy between these agents and swarms of bees that would come and sting you. And these are locusts, these swarms of locusts that would come and eat out your substance. And there you have some numbers and the growth of IRS agents. Which reminds me of an article that just appeared recently in the magazine Today's Chemist at Work. I don't know if any of you saw it or not. It says the heaviest element known to science was discovered recently. The element, tentatively named administratium, has no protons or electrons and thus an atomic number of zero. However, it does have one neutron, 125 assistant neutrons, 75 vice neutrons, and 111 vice assistant vice neutrons, which gives it an atomic mass of 312. These 312 particles are held together by a force that involves the continuous activity of particles called morons, which impede every reaction they come in contact with. According to discoverers, a minute amount of administratium causes reactions to take more than 4 days to complete when they would normally have occurred in less than a second. Administratium has a normal half-life of 4 years, at which time it does not decay, but instead undergoes reorganization, complete with catchy slogans. Studies show the atomic mass increases after reorganization, and the slogans are transitory. That's the big news from chemistry, although this is not a conference on Christianity and chemistry, but let's go to number four. Okay, this is the IRS code. Pages of law. 1913, they started out small. It didn't apply to many people, and they only had 14 pages of regulations, 14 pages of law. In 1992, it was up to 9,400. And of course, we have had tax reforms many times, and tax simplification and all sorts of things, and each time it's simplified, the number of pages increases. As to what is required, this increase here is only 670 times. When Richard Army was trying to sell his flat tax, the catchiest device he used was the idea that you can fill out your taxes on the back of a postcard. Because people were so sick of the forms and the regulations and the enormous amount of time wasted in keeping records demanded by the government and filling out forms demanded by the government. Number 25, and this is our last overhead, is about the Federal Register from 1935 to 1993. Let me tell you what the Federal Register is in case some of you haven't seen it. It's a book published daily, Monday through Friday, by the Government Printing Office. You can tell by the date there that it was first assembled in the Roosevelt administration in 1935. And it was supposed to be the place where all the executive agencies would publish their new regulations. Up until 1935, they were just scattered. There wasn't any central clearinghouse, as it were, or central authority one could go to check on new federal regulations. And the Federal Register is approximately 150 to 200 pages of fine print, comes out daily, three columns of fine print with new regulations in it. And the number of pages, as this graph shows, has grown from about 4,000 in 1935. It peaked in 1980 during the Carter administration at 87,000 pages that year. And now it's gone down to, in 1995, which is the latest figure I have, of 70,000 pages. And a lot of what goes on in Washington is due to the Federal Register. Lawyers are very well paid to do nothing but keep tabs of what is appearing or what will appear in the Federal Register and to inform their clients about pending federal regulations or regulations put into effect. One of the things I did when I worked on Capitol Hill was to glance through the Federal Register, at least when I started there, glance through the Federal Register on a daily basis to see what the agencies were putting in. And, of course, they make the law up as they go along. Congress has abdicated on its legislative responsibility. It has handed it over to the executive agencies. And the executive agencies take them and run with them. The IRS is only the most famous, perhaps, of the agencies that do that sort of thing. But there are thousands of them that do that sort of thing. And these regulations and pending regulations, it's a full-time job for law firms in Washington to keep track of what's going on. The burden of federal regulation has been measured in several ways. One example is what it takes to bring a new drug to market. A pharmaceutical company, in order to bring a new drug to market, can figure on 11 years of research and filling out forms before the drug is ready for market. 11 years, on average. At a cost of about $300 million. In many lives, by the way. It's not just a dollar cost involved, but many lives are lost with the FDA not giving its approval for new drugs until after approximately 11 years have elapsed. Well, that's all I have for the overheads. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that it's not enough to understand how much government has grown, although I hope that these statistics have given you a better idea of how much government has grown in the 20th century. But we also have to understand that that growth is wrong. Many people will look at these numbers and say, hey, this is great. This is exactly what government should be doing. They don't all walk away looking at the same set of statistics here with the same reaction. We have to understand that this growth of government is wrong. If you recall, again, 1 Samuel 8, you'll see how the government growth begins. It begins in idolatry. God tells Samuel, they're not rejecting you, Samuel. He says, don't take it personally. He says, they're rejecting me. And the demand of the people was, we want a king like all the nations around us. We want to have the same sort of government that they have. You hear the same argument today. You hear people saying all the time, the United States is the only industrialized nation that doesn't have a national health care system. Might not have a national hair care system either, I don't. There it is. We want a government like all the nations around us. Canada has one. Britain has one. France has one. We ought to have one. Same thing that you see in 1 Samuel 8. It begins in idolatry. It manifests itself in corruption. So they were taking bribes and perverting justice. The rulers, the judges of Egypt, the sons of Samuel, were perverting justice. The people were offering bribes and they were taking bribes. They were rejecting God and wanting a king. And they demanded a king who would go out before them and fight their battles. Now, sometimes you hear people say that the growth of government here is due to the failure of the churches. They weren't doing what they should have been doing. In one sense, that's wrong, and in one sense, that's right. Usually in the sense that people mean, and it's wrong. What they mean when you hear that frequently is the churches should have been taking care of the poor. The churches should have been taking care of the unemployed. Well, that's not the job of the church to do that. Now, you can say private charity can help it. But the church is not a welfare organization. Paul even gives us instructions as to who to give help to and who not. He says, don't give any help to a widow under 60. Many people miss that verse in the New Testament. The churches are not a welfare organization. The churches, Paul says, are to be teaching organizations, and they're not to be burdened with welfare. Now, you can have private charities for that, and that's fine. But there was a failure in the churches, and the failure was in the teaching. The failure was that the message of the churches had changed in the 19th century. The churches were apostatizing. They were leaving the gospel. They were abandoning the gospel. Far from preaching the whole counsel of God, many of them weren't even preaching the gospel. And that's the failure of the churches. If they had been preaching as they ought to have been, then the problem with statolatry, the idolatry of the state, the attitude that says, if you want anything, you go to Washington, or you go to Nashville, or you go to your local official to get it, rather than relying on yourself, your family, your friends, and God, that none of that would have happened. It was the growing idolatry in the U.S. in the 19th and 20th centuries, just as it was in ancient Israel, that led to the growth of government. So it's a fault in their teaching, not in the fact that they weren't operating welfare programs. We need to realize today, after you've had a chance to digest some of these statistics, that this growth of government, this to use a medical analogy, this cancerous growth of government, is simply a symptom of something much more serious in American society. And until that more serious matter is taken care of, the government will continue to grow in its power, and it will continue to grow in its criminality. It's not a solution. Big government is not a solution, never has been a solution for corruption, as the people of ancient Israel thought. But it's the source of much corruption. Now, are there any comments or questions? I've allowed, after all of our presentations, ample time for comments and questions, and then we'll all take a break. Go ahead, sir.
Could you comment on the relationship of many of the major governments and the local here for personal debt?
Good question. How about personal debt, personal lack of savings? This shows that the corruption isn't limited to the government. Because the personal savings rate, the economists tell us, is very low in the United States. Up until 10 years ago, it was very high in Japan, for example. The savings rate in Japan was about 20% up until about 10 years ago. And it's that enormous savings rate that accounts for a great deal of the Japanese economic miracle. In the United States, personal savings is falling. One of the reasons is, of course, our tax system. If you earn some money, you're taxed on what you earn. If you then put it in a bank, you're taxed on your interest. In Japan, up until recently, there was no double taxation of that sort. Those who saved were not punished for saving. In America, the tax system is structured such that those who save in that way are punished for saving. And that has contributed to a low personal savings rate. But I think, while it might explain part of it, it certainly doesn't explain the whole of it. What has happened is, what shall I call it, the future orientation of Americans is beginning to disappear. It used to be that Americans thought in terms of their lifetimes and their children's lifetimes and perhaps their grandchildren's lifetimes. Being raised on the Bible, America knew that it was the parents who were supposed to lay up for their children, as Paul puts it. They knew that a good man not only does that, but he lays up for his grandchildren, as Proverbs puts it. But in the 20th century, particularly since the 1960s again, the 1960s, I think, are a watershed in many ways. It's the me generation. We want satisfaction, and we want it now. So if we can't afford something, we use our credit card. We pile up an enormous credit card debt. We have stopped thinking in terms of grandchildren. Many times we've stopped thinking in terms of children. The abortion rate testifies to that. And we want instant gratification. And we want it now. Whatever it might be, we've got to have that new car, that new house, We've got to have that new video, that new CD, whatever it might be. We want it now, and we'll just use our credit card to get it. My daughter mentioned a figure the other day. I haven't checked it, but she said, what was that figure, Mary, about students coming out of college have an average credit card debt of what? $18,000. A credit card debt. This is not a student loan. Student loans are bad enough, but this is credit card debt. And this is a testimony to the consume now, pay for it later mentality. It's the disappearance of any orientation toward the future. And it's the growth of a present orientation that is a serious factor in undermining the American economy. I didn't give you any relative numbers on how this, the growth of the American economy has slowed recently, but it has. Yes, sir.
I have a former question. I've been on CBS News for the last couple of months, and they're saying that the figures could be somewhat deceiving in terms of personal savings because people are starting to push more money into larger homes, more expensive cars, saving putting into the stock market for retirement, IRA, that kind of thing. So the numbers are there, actually, they're bigger than what one can see in personal savings.
That is a good correction, and that might have some truth to it. The personal savings rate, though, had been declining long before that trend began, and I certainly wouldn't count a more expensive car as a form of saving. Perhaps one can argue that a house is, and one could argue that many Americans live in their savings accounts. They're hoping that their house will increase in value and their equity will increase. And in that sense, that certainly ought to be counted as a form of savings. But anything other than that, a car, you name it, I would say this is not savings at all, especially when you lease them. Yes, sir?
In the statistic on the indirect taxes, did that include the taxes built into the production of goods?
Yes, that's what that includes. Right, right. Yes, sir.
John, as a cliche, that you won't realize how expensive health care is until it's free. And your slide on health care escalating costs epitomizes how in the last two decades we have a health cost crisis, not a health care crisis.
Very good point. It's a health cost crisis driven by this enormous spending, particularly at the federal level. Yes, Neil.
First of all, the most disturbing of all those figures to me is the growth in federal government and government employees. Because they're deriving their own livelihood and are from the government itself. And you're having a decline in private industry, private economy. That is very, very scary. And the other thing that kind of goes along with that, with these federal agencies, is that they are arming themselves. The agencies that you wouldn't think would have a reason to arm themselves, or some of these increased employees are putting on people who carry arms, like PVA, for example, have recently tremendously increased the number of employees and have a trained force. And so does the IRS.
The trained police force.
Trained police force. And some of these agencies that you would think they have no reason to have an armed force are having an armed force now.
What excuse does the TVA give for having their own police force?
I don't know. But I know that they have increased the rate. I've met several. And they have increased them tremendously.
They're not going to be our meter readers, are they?
The other thing, you said that things are going well and everybody's accepting the growth of government while the economy's good. What happens when the economy goes bad?
Well, it gets worse when the economy goes bad. When the economy goes bad, I think the demand for more government is going to be much worse than it is now. the growth in the economy has caused people to tolerate it. But they're going to demand government programs when the economy goes sour. What happened in the 1930s during the Great Depression? There you saw much of the demand coming, as it were, from Washington for greater government, but they had the best salesman in the world, Franklin Roosevelt. And he persuaded millions of Americans that he had the solution. In the 1930s, though, the American society still had some vestiges of Christian ideas, Christian social ideas. In the 1990s, I don't know that we do. And it's that lack of a Christian basis 60 years later that if the economy goes sour, there will be an even greater demand. You saw it recently in the flood in North Carolina, where the governor got on television and said, "We don't want loans. We want grants. We want outright gifts of something like $4.6 billion to help us out here in North Carolina." And he was very adamant about it, very demanding, very self-righteous. "We don't want loans," he said. "You can take your federal loan programs. What we want is federal grant programs." And that's the sort of thing that I fear will become very widespread if the economy turns sour. The whole underlying mindset of the population has changed in the 20th century. Yes, sir.
Two questions. One, in terms of studies of the federal budget, education, what Walter said, then the other one is as far as percentage of take home or income. How has that percentage increased to half of what it is today? Was it more back in 1913, or how has that number progressed?
I don't have the historical data on that. In fact, I don't have the data on education. Let me ask our speakers, though. Calvin or Ron, do you have any idea how much federal spending on education has changed?
Before the 1960s, federal spending on education was practically nil.
Before the 1960s, federal spending on education was practically nil. Even today, federal education spending only makes up, I think, about 3% of total education spending in the country. And so when we think about education as, you know, this juggernaut that we need to keep from growing so much, we really do, on that one, need to focus far more on state and local than on the federal level. And if we want to bring that under control, we need to do it at the local level. And actually, that's good news, because it's a whole lot easier to do it there. All you have to do is get elected to your local school board, and that's usually a pretty easy thing to do. The percentage, your second question, if I understand correctly, was percentage of gross pay that turned out to be take home?
You said about 50% of our income is taxes.
Okay.
And that's 1994. So back then,
from here I can't see. I couldn't see the overhead, so I don't know how detailed John's figures on that were. But my own memory, from having traced that myself and done some graphs of that, is that the combined federal, state, and local has kind of fluctuated around the region of about 42% to about 47-48%. Essentially, from the early 50s to the present, there have been a few significant drops below 40%, a couple of times under the Reagan administration, if I remember correctly. But aside from that, it's been within that range pretty steadily the whole time. The huge increase really took place under the Depression era. That was when the permanent increase came.
Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
I've heard many people make comments online that the current good economy is being largely fueled by the high tech companies and the biggies like Microsoft and things like that. Any comments on the federal proceedings against Microsoft?
The question is, any comments on the federal proceedings against Microsoft? Well, I guess nothing in specific about Microsoft. The federal government, of course, has no business in antitrust actions. Antitrust law is a joke. the old story about antitrust laws is that they're such a jumble and so chaotic that you can convict a businessman, any businessman in the country, of violating them. And to give one example with pricing, under the law, if a businessman charges more than his competitors for a product, he's guilty of price gouging and subject to legal action because of that. If he charges less, he's trying to corner the market. And that's one of the complaints against Microsoft. They're giving away their programs, and this is hurting the American consumer. And if the businessman charges the same as his competitors, that's collusion. So they've got him whether he charges less, more, or the same as his competitors. And I'm not sure what the political motivation is for the Justice Department going after after Microsoft. Power.
Do you think we can see more of that enforcement?
I think anybody who comes up on the radar screen of the bureaucrats in Washington can expect to hear from them. And Bill Gates and Microsoft did that. And it's not always big guys that do it either. I had a call prior to this conference a couple weeks ago about a businessman here in Tennessee who was put out of business by the Tennessee Department of Environmental Resources because they claimed he was doing something that was illegal. It had something to do with wetlands. I've forgotten what it was. And but they drove him out of business. And he's, compared to Bill Gates, he's zilch. But the number of laws and regulations and their confusing mass means that every one of us is a lawbreaker. And it just is up to the bureaucrats as to whether they take a dislike to you for some reason, whether they're going to prosecute any action against you. I hate to tell you that, but that's the case. And that's the intention, in my opinion. That is the intention, to make us all guilty, insofar as possible, of violating some rule or regulation or another, so that a guilty people can be very easily manipulated. Any other comments or questions? Oh, Dr. Patterson.
The federal government is responsible to maintain the common defense and the general welfare. Here's a comment on the sense of general welfare in 1800 compared with today. I'm not sure general welfare has any meaning with the implication of the regulations. So.
Right. Good question. How has the meaning of the phrase general welfare changed from 1800 to 1999? And as you know, the phrase comes from the preamble to the Constitution, both the reference to the general welfare and provide for the common defense. And I think in the minds of the framers, general welfare referred to those matters that could not be handled by the states, that concerned all the states, that is, such things as defense, such things as foreign policy, and were best handled by the general government, the national government, rather than by state or local governments. It occurs to me that the phrase common defense has changed in meaning too. When they talked about defense, they had the defense of the borders in mind. They had no idea that we were going to have troops in Korea and Somalia and half of the nations on the face of the earth when they talked about common defense. But in the name of defense, we have. And I think that is as much of a corruption of what they meant as the general welfare clause. Today you hear people appealing to the general welfare clauses as saying, yes, that's the basis for federal welfare programs. Well, that's an equivocation of the worst sort. To argue that the framers advocated welfare programs because they said something about general welfare in the preamble. They had nothing of the sort in mind. It was those matters that could best be handled by a national or a general government, such as foreign policy and defense. Yes, so, Calvin?
Just for anybody who wants to follow up on that, Joseph Story, who was one of the early members of the Supreme Court and wrote both a large four-volume commentary on the Constitution and a high school-level textbook called A Familiar Exposition of the Constitution, which I now use with my college students and terribly challenges them. Story explains the general welfare clause very well and shows precisely what John just said, that for the founders, general meant national, not state, not county, not municipal, and certainly not familial or individual. General meant national. And that the familiar exposition, by the way, is about to come back into print from Regnery in Washington. It's supposed to come off the press in December.
Any other comments or questions? Yes, sir.
You said that because the economy is going so good, that's why people are happy with the increase in government.
They may not be happy. They're willing to tolerate it. Yeah.
But so much of what government does is done poorly. And so now, in addition to paying your taxes, you have to spend money to educate your own kids. And other instances, for example, burglar alarms and all this kind of stuff that protect your safety. Will these things make people less, will they work the other way and help people become less dependent on government or away from government, do you think?
No. And I think the point I want to make is philosophical. The only thing that will change people's minds is other ideas. Events do not change people's minds. Facts, as it were, do not change people's minds. You can have the same event. As I mentioned earlier, I could have shown these graphs to a different audience and they would have loved these. This is wonderful what's happening. What will change people's minds is ideas. It's the preaching of the gospel that is absolutely fundamental. Ross made the comment the other night, he doesn't know too many people who came to an understanding of the proper role of government from reading some secular writer, but he knows many people who came to that understanding from reading the Bible. And I think that's very important. The same event will happen to two different people who have different sets of ideas in their minds, and they'll interpret that event in two completely different ways. So, the worsening condition of the public schools, you'll see people with two different sets of ideas reacting in two completely different ways. One set of people will say, well, this indicates we have to have Christian schools and homeschooling, and we have to get rid of the public school system. The other set of people will say, well, this indicates we have to spend more on the public schools. Same event happens. You can have a massacre in Columbine. You can have declining test scores, whatever measure you want. Call it an event. But the judgment that people make about that will differ precisely because of their presuppositions, the ideas that they have in their mind. And it's at that level, the idea level, that the battle has to be fought. If we have, as Neil brought up earlier, if we have a situation in which the economy takes a downturn, there's an event. But the people are going to react in two different ways to it. At least two different ways. And don't place any stock in events changing minds. It's ideas that change minds. And when we're talking about the gospel, it's the Holy Spirit that changes minds, not political or economic events.
Follow up on a question there about the inefficiency. Actually, they demand or are demanding a more efficient government. More efficient.
Yeah. People demand a more efficient government. That is, we want all the government we pay for. Well, we don't want all the government we pay for. And one of the best examples of the wisdom of the framers was in making the government inefficient. It's an inefficient system to have people sitting in Congress debating things. And the American people are disgusted with Congress because all they do is talk about things. Well, that's precisely what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to talk things to death. That was the idea of the framers. But you see a demand for action, and that centers on the president. And the president has to do something. He needs to get something done, as opposed to a do-nothing Congress. And that's the demand for dictatorship. That's the demand for the Führer. That's the demand for the leader. And people, when they start demanding efficiency of that sort, we're in a bad way.